Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This we represent Greg Grandin, professor of history at New York University, who discusses the latest developments in Honduras after ousted President Manuel Zelaya clandestinely returned to his nation, taking refuge in the Brazilian embassy. Eric Seitz, attorney for Native American activist and political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who discusses his client's recent unsuccessful attempt to be released on parole. And journalism professor Christopher Martin, who summarizes the results of a study he and Professor Peter Dreyer conducted on the corporate media's flawed coverage of alleged scandals surrounding the community organizing group ACORN. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The U.S. diplomatic mission in Iraq has replaced Blackwater with a new security firm, a company with its own troubling history known as Triple Canopy. According to the investigative website ProPublica, Triple Canopy has been under criminal investigation since 2007 for allegedly using stolen cars and captured Iraqi weapons to boost its profits on government contracts. The key question for investigators is how the security firm, formed in 2003, obtained weapons for its early security contracts in Iraq. Triple Canopy was not granted its first weapons import license until June 2004. Initially, the company, founded by two former Special Forces soldiers, bought weapons off the Iraqi street. A mid-level manager told investigators he feared the proceeds of these sales were funding the insurgency. Stuart Brown, a special investigator general for Iraqi reconstruction, says it is difficult to know if Triple Canopy did anything technically illegal, but their actions were symptomatic of the chaos that prevailed at the time. The news magazine In These Times reports that natural gas companies have rediscovered the old oil wells of western Pennsylvania, the birthplace of the American energy industry. Drillers are now extracting natural gas that is more than 6,000 feet below the surface, buried underneath a layer of rock known as the Marcellus Shale. The rock formation extends from Ohio to West Virginia and up to the Catskill Mountains in New York. The process drillers use to extract methane gas is called hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. A driller will pump up to 9 million gallons of water mixed with sand and chemicals at very high pressure to fracture the shale and release the natural gas. Energy industry analysts say over $1 trillion worth of recoverable natural gas rests under the Marcellus Shale. Critics point to all the chemicals used in fracking and wonder how they will be stored. The secret chemical mixture is often left in lined open pits. In northern Louisiana, 17 cows died in April after frack water leaked into a pasture. In Congress, a number of Democrats are pushing a bill that would force drilling companies to reveal the chemical mixture used in fracking. Halliburton developed fracking in Texas in the 1940s and never revealed the chemical compound. Halliburton won protections in 2005 from the Bush administration as oil and gas companies were exempted from following sections of the Safe Drinking Water Act. The financial crisis has been hard on domestic workers in Manhattan like Dolores Wright, an immigrant from Jamaica. Domestic workers have to fight to save their low-paying jobs and resist abuse by wealthy employers. At the same time, domestic workers in New York State are on the verge of an historic victory in passing a domestic workers' bill of rights that has won the backing of Governor David Patterson. The bill would give legal protections to 200,000 nannies, housekeepers, and elder caregivers in the Empire State. The legislation was set for passage last June, but fell victim to the epic power struggle that shut down the state Senate for weeks. Organizing of domestic workers dates back to the 1880s when the Atlanta-based Washing Society supported a housekeeper's strike for higher wages. In recent years, organizing has been driven by globalization as people left poor countries for the developed world seeking jobs. According to The Nation magazine, the Empire State organizing drive started in 2003, after New York City passed a law mandating that employment agencies urge homeowners to honor minimum wage, overtime, and Social Security laws. Labor rights activists are hoping that a new domestic workers' bill of rights law in New York State will trigger a wave of organizing around the country, especially in California, where organizers plan to push for a bill of rights in 2010. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Just days after Honduran President Manuel Zelaya, overthrown in a June 28th coup d'etat, clandestinely returned to his nation and took refuge in the Brazilian embassy on September 21st, the coup government's president, Roberto Micheletti, suspended constitutional rights and the freedom of assembly. Micheletti also forcibly closed down media outlets viewed as supportive of Zelaya. But after leaders of the Honduran Congress objected to the decree, Micheletti announced that he would soon ask the Supreme Court to rescind his suspension of civil liberties. President Zelaya, holed up with dozens of supporters in the Brazilian embassy, claimed that the Honduran military, which had surrounded the building, were subjecting people inside to a neurotoxic gas that caused many of them to become ill. The coup government had given Brazil an ultimatum of 10 days to either grant Mr. Zelaya asylum or hand him over for arrest. Zelaya's surprise return to Honduras threw the coup government into apparent disarray. Micheletti had invited officials of the Organization of American States to come to Honduras to prepare for talks, but then blocked four members of the group from entering the country. He later issued a new invitation for an OAS delegation to return. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with New York University professor of history Greg Grandin, who discusses the latest developments in Honduras, the role of social movements, and mixed signals sent by the Obama administration on restoring democratic rule to the Central American nation.
Manuel Zelaya remains in the Brazilian embassy, subject to steady harassment. There's been reports that there's been audio harassment, loud, high-pitched noise meant to create all sorts of disturbances and difficulties with the people inside the embassy. There's been reports of tear gas and other chemicals being sent into the embassy. And I think this coup may be on its, maybe it's a little bit too optimistic, but it may be on its last legs, or it's certainly isolating itself in the international community. You have to remember that the strategy of the people who carried out the coup was to present to the world the argument that this was a constitutional change of government, that this wasn't a coup, that it was a lawful and legal transition from one president to another, a president who supposedly violated the Constitution. And with every action that the coup government takes, I think that argument is revealed to be what it is, a lie.
Now, the de facto government has given Brazil a 10-day ultimatum to deliver Zelaya to them. What's your take on the threats coming out of the de facto government towards the Brazilian government?
I don't believe there's any way that the Honduran government could enforce that ultimatum. If it did, I think it would be even more isolated. Again, remember that its only chance is to get the rest of the world to agree to acknowledge the outcome of these elections scheduled on November 29th. And I think images of the Honduran military storming the Brazilian embassy would be pretty damning.
The United States recently condemned Manuel Zelaya's return to Honduras, where he's holed up in the Brazilian embassy, labeling him as irresponsible and, you know, possibly fomenting violence in the streets through his call to his supporters to rise up and protest and bring down this illegitimate government as he sees it. What do you make of this criticism from the United States government, the Obama administration here?
Well, since the beginning of the coup, since June 28th, now coming on 3 months, the U.S. has sent mixed signals. Barack Obama himself has at times sent very strong message to Honduras that he thought that this was a coup. We called it such. And he at different points demanded the restitution of Zelaya. In many ways, Obama was responding to pressure from other Latin American countries, the Organization of American States and Brazil. On the other hand, there were been elements within the State Department, within maybe you could think of it as the Hillary Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, that has been more circumspect in its condemnation of the coup and the people who carried out the coup. They've been forced little by little to ratchet up the pressure, suspending visas and and eventually coming out with a statement saying that it wouldn't recognize the as of now, the November 29th elections. But these kind of comments and trying from different spokesmen within the State Department, within the government, have been a constant since the coup, another indication of that, of the mixed messages that the Obama administration is sending.
Now, what is the power of the grassroots organizations that have taken to the streets at their own peril, arrest and some killing of these protesters at the hands of the police and the military? What power do they have to restore Zelaya to power at this point?
Well, I would say that around June 28th, Zelaya had the support of the organized sector of the population, unionists, peasant organizations, members of the gay and lesbian and feminist community, environmentalists, but pretty much the people who were consciously political, understood themselves as members of the left. I think over the, what's happened over the last 2.5 months is that that base has grown as the economy has suffered as a result of the coup, as these successive curfews, all, you know, 24-hour curfews, indefinite curfews at times, alienate people. They don't have access to food. They don't have access to markets. Small businesses are shuttered. I think the opposition and the discontent is growing well beyond that organized base of the population. Now, at the same time, I think that organized base of the population has gotten the strongest sense of itself. It's been actually very strategic. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that everything that the coup plotters feared Zelaya would do, and probably the reason why they overthrew him, because they were afraid of his alliance and cultivation of the popular movement, they've actually brought into being as a result of the coup. They've polarized the country. They've created a sense of massive delegitimation of state institutions, and they've basically strengthened the popular movement as a result of that coup. So there's a kind of ironic kind of summoning into being what they hope to prevent.
Well, do these groups have any hope of influencing the outcome of a November 29th election or whatever election comes in the coming days?
Well, I don't think so. I think that Honduras has been basically ruled by either a candidate of the Liberal Party or the National Party since the 1860s, except for periods of military rule. It's really a two-party system. When I say two-party system, it's even more restricted than the two-party system in the United States. It's really, you know, the leaders of these parties really come out of a small economic clique, and they pretty much control the electoral machinery. Prior to the coup, it was clear that either a Liberal Party candidate or the National Party candidate was going to win. Since the coup, the National Party candidate had the advantage because the Liberal Party split. But again, it was one or the other. I think the influence of these social movements isn't going to be in the electoral realm. I think it's going to be through the creation of a grassroots movement.
That was Greg Grandin, professor of history at New York University and author of Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City. He serves on the editorial committee of the North American Congress on Latin America. For up-to-date regional reports on the situation in Honduras, visit the website HondurasCoup2009.blogspot.com. Native American human rights activist Leonard Peltier has been incarcerated for more than 33 years. He was convicted of the murder of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. Violence on the reservation occurred during a time of open warfare between Indian traditionalists and the corrupt tribal leadership, while U.S. government forces occupied the land. Peltier's trial was riddled with improprieties, including withholding by the government of exculpatory evidence and coercion of witnesses, all amid an atmosphere of great fear and intimidation. Peltier has always claimed he did not shoot the FBI agents. Two other Indian activists arrested for the same crime but tried separately were acquitted based on their claim of self-defense. Members of the FBI have always been active in opposing every motion for a new trial and challenged a request for clemency from former President Bill Clinton. This summer, Peltier came up for parole after serving the required minimum 15 years on each murder conviction. But the George W. Bush-appointed members of the Federal Parole Commission denied Peltier parole. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Eric Seitz, Peltier's attorney, about this latest development and what might lie ahead.
The Parole Commission consists of five people appointed by the president. There are only four because there's one vacancy. The current chairman of the commission was a holdover commissioner from the Bush administration, but he was appointed as chairman by President Obama. The other three members are holdovers from the Bush commission and are not people that we had any particular anticipation would be sympathetic.
Given that scenario, how optimistic were you going into the parole hearing?
We were optimistic to some extent because this was the first time that Leonard was actually appearing at a time when he was eligible under the statutory and regulatory criteria. And secondly, we're optimistic because Leonard is now 65 years old, or was a month short of 65, and has serious medical problems. And there have been definite policies in the federal prisons to parole people based upon age and physical infirmity. And so we thought that all of those things considered, coupled with the controversy about the case, which has always raised at least some dissatisfaction, even in circles where people are not too sympathetic to Leonard or to the causes that he represents, that this case was mishandled. And we thought that maybe at this point in time, there would be some realistic assessment that we have to fix this, and that the way to fix it is to release him and allow him to live the rest of his life outside of prison.
And how long did it take the commission to decide they weren't going to release him?
Well, we had a six-hour hearing, not before the commissioners themselves, but before an examiner who was appointed by the commission to conduct the hearing. That in and of itself was somewhat unique. I've never had a parole hearing that lasted that long, either on a state or federal case. And then, we had the hearing on the 28th of July, and I think we got the decision on the 22nd of August. And the decision was a very brief two-page decision, simply saying that because of the nature of the offense, that they would not consider paroling him and come back and see us in another 15 years.
Eric Seitz, I know Peltier spent many years in prisons in both Illinois and Kansas, where his family could more easily visit him. But he's been in Lewisburg Penitentiary in Pennsylvania for the last few years, which seems like additional punishment, being so far away from family and friends.
We've made efforts in the past and been hopeful that we could get him back toward the area where his family is, but that has not worked out for a number of reasons, and that's also a consideration at this point that we're investigating.
What are Leonard Peltier's options at this point?
Well, we filed an appeal, which is what we're obligated to do, but since it's going back to the same people, we don't anticipate that we're going to get any different result. After that, we then have a choice to make. We can probably file a lawsuit against the Parole Commission in the Western District of Pennsylvania, which is the area where Leonard is now incarcerated, arguing that the criteria that they have utilized here are illegal and impermissible and essentially deny parole in violation of the applicable laws and regulations, which we believe to be the case. Or alternatively, and I say alternatively because we can't do both, we can try and seek some sort of favorable action from the Obama administration to try and get Leonard out of prison because of his health and for other reasons that I've mentioned. We are trying to figure out now what the best course of action would be, and when we get that appeal, we will then decide which way we're going to go with that.
And if you go to the Obama administration, what would you ask for? A pardon or clemency? Or something else?
Well, the president has plenary authority over federal prisoners. He can do whatever he wants. He can order the person pardoned, which we would never seek because politically that would never happen. He can grant clemency in some form, which means to allow the person to be released for time served, or he can reduce the sentence and order the person be released after a certain additional period of time, or he can order the parole commission to release him on parole. We don't know at this point what we're going to do. We're investigating. We're talking to people. We're inquiring. We understand that it would be a very difficult political decision at this point for this new administration to take any favorable action because it would be very controversial and it would be anathema to the FBI and other law enforcement agencies that have taken strong positions in this case. On the other hand, we understand that there are lots of people who support Leonard and feel that he should never have been convicted in the first place and that having served 34 years, it's time to allow him to go home, and we're hopeful that we can come up with a resolution that will cause that to happen sooner than later.
That was Eric Seitz, attorney for Native American activist Leonard Peltier, currently imprisoned at Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary. For more information, contact the Leonard Peltier Defense Offense Committee at area code 701-235-2206 or visit their website at whoisleonardpeltier.info. Thank you. when two conservative activists, posing as a pimp and prostitute, released covert videotapes showing the staff of the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, or ACORN, offering the phony couple assistance to evade federal tax laws, conservative groups with the support of corporate media immediately demanded an investigation and the defunding of the group. Congress quickly complied, passing resolutions cutting off federal funds to one of the nation's leading social justice organizing groups. ACORN has long been a target of the Republican Party and the conservative movement for their successful voter registration drives, getting large numbers of low-income and minority citizens to the polls. But the group, with 400,000 members and offices in 75 cities, also effectively has advocated for increases in the minimum wage and assisted poor families to purchase homes across the nation. It was this largely unreported history of political antagonism between ACORN and the GOP that prompted journalism professor Christopher Martin and politics professor Peter Dreyer of Occidental College to conduct an independent study of the corporate media's flawed coverage of ACORN during the 2008 U.S. presidential campaign. Here, Professor Martin of the University of Northern Iowa summarizes his study titled Manipulating the Public Agenda, Why ACORN Was in the News and What the News Got Wrong. The study found the media often repeated unverified allegations and distortions regarding charges that ACORN was engaged in committing voter fraud.
We actually looked at 647 stories and found that, you know, what happens is that the stories, particularly about ACORN, you know, start with conservative media and conservative opinion entrepreneurs, so people like bloggers, lots of blogs and websites, filters up the conservative media like Rush Limbaugh on radio, like Glenn Beck on Fox and others on Fox News, like Lou Dobbs on CNN, who is actually, in our study, turned out to be just as conservative as everyone on Fox, and then later gets picked up by the mainstream media. Mainstream newspapers like Washington Post, New York Times, and others. And what we found is that those frames, the way that the conservatives and Republicans framed the story about ACORN, was pretty much taken the same exact way by the mainstream media. So, you know, if you're looking for liberal bias, I mean, we just didn't find it. I mean, in fact, we found, you know, if anything else, more conservative bias, because what the mainstream media failed to do in many cases, and actually the majority of the cases, actually fact-check these stories and these allegations that were coming up from the conservative opinion entrepreneurs and the conservative news media. So in terms of last fall, the big story in October 2008 was that, and it was kind of an October surprise in a way, was that ACORN was conducting voter fraud. And that was kind of the initial allegation. And the mainstream media carried that without pointing out, you know, one, that voter fraud and voter registration fraud are two very different things. And they what ACORN had was some rogue employees who they'd hired to register voters, as they register voters like lots of organizations around the country. And some people decided to not do their work and, you know, put in phony names that we've probably heard of, like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. And, you know, ACORN flagged those as they had to, required by law to turn over all the voter registration forms that get turned back in, even ones that look funny to them. And they turn them back to the county boards of elections, say, these don't look right. ACORN ends up getting blamed for doing what's called voter fraud. It wasn't. It was actually just some voter registration irregularities in certain cases. And it would get, you know, made much more into it in the news media than it actually turned out to be. In fact, even John McCain, if you remember the last presidential debate in October, middle October, said ACORN's now on the verge of maybe perpetuating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying the fabric of democracy. With many months removed from that, we realized that didn't happen, and that it was a great exaggeration. And I think, you know, we saw it back in our study, and I think we're seeing a little bit of that same thing right now.
What's the connection, Professor Martin, between the Republican Party's documented history of suppressing voters in particular districts, Democrats, and particularly minority populations, and their attack on ACORN?
Well, this is one of the main reasons why the Republicans don't like ACORN, is ACORN registers voters. One of the activities, they do some other things that they don't like as well, but they register voters in mostly urban areas. I mean, ACORN's in about 70-plus markets around the country in urban areas, and the people they're registering who live in those areas, mostly Latinos and Latinas and African-Americans, tend to vote Democratic. And so the GOP doesn't like them, and actually if you go back historically, you know, I'm not making this up. The GOP actually had a website in May 2009 called stopacorn.gop.org. So, I mean, it's not, we're not making up anything to say the GOP doesn't like Acorn. I mean, they've been pretty explicit about it in that instance. But they were also explicit about it back in 2006, and it's become more clear to us when testimony from Karl Rove became released just this past August. But it became very clear that the firings, and I think your listeners will remember, the firings of the eight U.S. attorneys in 2006 by the Bush administration, and these were actually Republican U.S. attorneys that George Bush had actually appointed, were because those attorneys weren't manufacturing charges and indictments against Acorn back in 2006 as they were trying to, you know, pressure, and try to discourage certain voters from voting in that election. So there's been a long-term effort here, and actually David Iglesias in New Mexico was one of the outspoken attorneys, again a Republican, but he said, you know, they were trying to politicize our job and make us bring stuff against Acorn, and that's just not right. So it's been a long-standing animosity. It was kind of below the surface of a lot of news media, at least mainstream media in 2006, although it was certainly in the conservative media, but it blew up in a big way by the fall of 2008. In part because, and I think if Hillary Clinton had been the Democratic nominee, it may not have been as big of a story, but because Obama had a little bit of a linkage to Acorn in his past, they were really trying to tie Obama to, you know, a smeared Acorn organization and said that he was, you know, he's just as bad as Acorn, and they're trying to actually say that the Obama's mounting this big left-wing conspiracy to actually steal the election with voter fraud. So you can see how these things start out in very small in the conservative media, and there's a number of true believers there, and then it gets carried over, sadly, by the mainstream media without any fact-checking. And that's actually the really saddest element for the majority of the country that relies on those news organizations for their news.
That was Christopher Martin, professor of journalism at the University of Northern Iowa, co-author of a study titled Manipulating the Public Agenda, Why Acorn Was in the News and What the News Got Wrong. Read the study online at MediaCrit.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Topp. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.